Hi, I'm Leanne Ward.
And I'm Susie Burrell.
And welcome to The Nutrition Couch, a weekly podcast from two of Australia's leading dietitians bringing you everything that is new in the world of nutrition, diets, and good food. From The Nutrition Couch today, we're chatting about a media article which asks, what is more influential, diet or exercise for weight loss? Our client case study of the week is about perimenopause. And on our most popular segment, the supermarket product of the week, we discuss the new sugar-free cake mixes in our supermarkets. And in our final segment, one of our listeners has asked us how to approach nutrition for young girls as they go through puberty. But before we kick into this week's episode, Susie, how are you going?
Oh, I'm struggling a little bit, Leanne. We're right in lockdown. I find everyone is really cranky, and an observation I've had in this really intense COVID period that we're going through is that whatever people's underlying personality is, it seems to be exaggerated. So if you're anxious, you become more anxious. If you're depressive, you tend to become lower in your mood. And I'm struggling a little bit. I've got kids at home trying to teach them maths, trying to get them to add up dollars and cents. I don't think it's that difficult, but my children are really struggling. And so this is nice to come and talk something positive. And I made my husband take the children away and said, don't bring them back for at least 2 hours, just so I can have a minute to myself. So this is the highlight of my week.
Love it. So if the adult conversation on the nutrition couch is the highlight of your week, thank you for being with us.
Exactly.
And I agree. It's tough for especially our Sydney-siders. So we're feeling you guys, Sydney. Stay strong. And we hope that the Nutrition Couch every Sunday gets you through a tough week.
And I do have some exciting news. I finally managed to get you to send me a bump picture. And so I'll pop that up for our listeners as well. So we've got something to look at. And I like to see those photos. I think it's nice. It's a reminder that there's bigger, more important things out there when people are having new babies and things. So that's a nice addition to this week's episode.
Getting to the halfway mark and it's getting harder to hide. All right, Susie. So what was trending in the media this week was an article that you found in the Times, and it was titled, What is more influential for weight loss? Is it diet or is it exercise? And I think it's a really interesting conversation because I personally know a lot of my followers try to, for lack of a better word, out-exercise a poor diet, right? So a lot of people overemphasize exercise and underemphasize how important nutrition is from a fat loss perspective. So I've got my own thoughts around this, but Susie, how do you feel about this? Is it diet or is it exercise just when we're talking about weight loss?
This is a really common question that we're asked, you know, what is more important? And indeed, I think we've all been guilty of thinking that if we've indulged a little bit over the weekend, we'll simply do a bit more exercise to buffer it out. I know that each day I tend to do a bit of a mental calculation when it comes to doling out the treats at night. So it's not necessarily a healthy way to think of it, but it is a common question that comes up, and hence the headline that I saw. And I also thought when I picked it for our chat today that we'd probably have slightly differing opinions on this. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was always nice for a chat to get some different perspectives of two different clinicians working with different people. So I do have some fairly set thoughts on it. And the way I describe it to people when they ask me or in the media or with clients is that I say, when we start with a weight loss journey, so you may have a goal of losing 5 kilos or 10 kilos, in the initial stages, in my experience, I like to focus on diet. So for the first 4, 6, 8, even 12 weeks, I tend to give a lot of attention to developing a strong eating plan with very set calorie and macronutrient targets, because I know that if my client is adherent to that program and for that first week or two or three can be relatively strict and keep calories tightly controlled and not be lured by a weekend of wine and extras, that I'm going to get at least a couple of kilos weight loss on the scales. And I know psychologically that that is one of the most significant predictors of long-term weight loss success. It's getting initial results. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason that I tend to say it's more important initially is that if we're talking about calories, and specifically women and smaller women, which is 90% of the group that I work with, I'm only dealing with calories between, say, 1,200, 1,400 and maybe up to 1,800 for my most active females. That's a pretty small number overall, really. So they may start on 1,200 calories or 1,400 calories, and then inevitably they're probably going to increase that as they become more metabolically efficient and better at burning calories, and hopefully over time becoming more active. But they're never going to be eating 800 calories. They're never going to be eating 2,500 calories. So I've only got a set period of time to get that calorie load controlled and right for them. And then eventually when they've lost a little bit, might be 5, might be 10, and of course depending on how long or how much weight they've got to lose, eventually the only thing that I can really change around is how much they're moving or how much activity they're doing, or specifically training in a way that's going to make their body more efficient at burning or build more muscle tissue so they can build more calories. So I'm not dealing with a group of women who are doing physique changing significantly in the sense of really getting into the gym, and then also not working on overly strict body fat goals of getting it, say, below 20%. I'm working with the average woman who's age, say, late 30s, mid 40s, who is going to do a little bit of exercise and she wants to lean up, but she's not wanting to be a fitness physique model. And hence, if I can get her to focus on the diet and getting that really strong and a really strong foundation for a period, so that becomes the default, eventually when it comes to those bigger weight loss, that's when, for me, the exercise becomes more important. But I know your position is a little bit different, and I think that that's great for us to sometimes have different positions on that. So I say initially, for that first weight loss, diet absolutely more important for me, because that's where people either are really adherent or go off the rails very quickly. And then it becomes more about getting your body more metabolically efficient and really looking at the training over time.
I agree with you there. And what I tend to do with my clients, I work with mostly active females, so they're already quite active. A lot of them are potentially even too active. I think they're trying to out-exercise a bad diet. Like a lot of people who sign up to my coaching services, you know, are working out 7 times a week, sometimes twice a day, and they're still gaining weight and their nutrition scraps. So really what we do is we taper back the exercise and really focus on nutrition, because purely for fat loss, 100% nutrition is king. I always say that nutrition is king, exercise is queen, together they make it kingdom. Said it before multiple times on my own podcast and others I've been interviewed on, and it really resonates with people, because most people do have too many treats. And then what we tend to do as humans is underestimate our nutrition and overestimate our exercise. So I've seen so many clients who are like, oh, I burnt 800 calories in my gym session because my fitness watch tells me. I'm like, I can promise you, you're not burning. Knowing what they've done and the intensity that they did it at, they have not burnt 800 calories in that session. I can promise you that. So then what they do is they go and supplement that with like 4 glasses of wine on a Thursday night or something like that. So I really think trying to match, you know, the calories burned to the calories that you're eating is just a really inaccurate way for a lot of people. So I 100% prioritize nutrition for my clients from a fat loss perspective. And then if clients have a goal of getting leaner, toner, stronger, you know, squatting 70, 80, 90, 100 kilos, that's where, of course, exercise becomes incredibly important. But not just exercise, the right type of exercise for the goal that the client has, and also to keep us metabolically strong. So if we have a significant amount of weight to lose, 10, 20, 30 kilos, we have to be doing some sort of exercise in order to keep us metabolically strong, in order to allow us to continue to be in a deficit for longer and longer. Because, you know, 20, 30 kilos could take 6 months plus to really get off. And if we're just low calorie, low calorie, low calorie, sure, we're going to lose, but we're going to come to the point where we stall and we plateau. And that's where the exercise component does become really important. But I get my clients to put 90% of the focus into nutrition, because most of them are already exercising. And then we just use exercise as that mental health component. It helps us sleep better. It helps us to reduce stress and anxiety. It makes us feel good. It gives us more energy. So that's how I like my clients to think about exercise, which I'm sure you do as well, Susie. I just think that, you know, most people overemphasize exercise. So from my point of view, for fat loss, nutrition is 100% key. And you can lose body fat without doing any exercise. Sure, exercise is going to make it a lot easier. And we, of course, encourage exercise from a mental health and a general health point of view. But you can purely lose body fat from a nutrition side of things only.
And I think the two things that have come up for me just as we're chatting, the first is that probably one of the other reasons I tend to focus purely on diet initially is that I find a lot of my clients are overwhelmed in their lives. They're very busy. They're working full time. They're juggling kids. They're single parents. And to just layer more and more and more onto their to-do list sometimes can be a bit overwhelming. So my clients tend to be a little bit older than yours, so they do tend to have a few more of those variables to be dealing with. So we all have to eat. So I often say to them, look, let's just start with getting the diet structured and some meal planning and some food prep going, because that's a big job in itself if you're not used to it. And then let's build from there and just start with some basic movement, because that doesn't add too much stress to them. So I think that's the first thing. And I think the other thing is that people tend to be either on or off in their mind. So a big part of any intervention is really coming to an understanding and a sense of peace with the fact that this isn't a plan that you're on now. This is the way forward forever. And still, I think it's a common thing that people are confused of. They think they're going to be on the diet and then they're off it, as opposed to thinking of this is actually long-term the way to get the foundation of the diet. This isn't a short-term thing. The only thing that might change is you might start eating a little bit more at night as you've lost weight, or you might have two meals off a week rather than one when you're actually trying to lose weight. But really, this is the way of eating moving forward, because this is what's ticking the box on all of your key nutrients, as well as at the moment supporting weight loss. So I think that's a big psychological hurdle to get over, to think this isn't what I'm just doing now. This is what I'm going to be doing forever. And it's sometimes approached, I guess, with a minimalist attitude as well, because people think, right, I can be really strict with diet, or I can do this much exercise now, knowing that eventually they're going to stop. And again, I prefer to build the habit, starting with the food, of things that people are going to be able to do long term, than throw everything at the problem, all the exercise, all the diet at once, and know that they're probably going to get tired and over it within a few weeks. So I'm always planning for the long term, particularly when someone presents who's wanting to lose 20, 30 kilos.
100%. And that mindset's so key. And if you're going to go 100% gung-ho in week one and you're going to lose the weight in week two, three, four, and everything's fine and dandy, but by week five and six, you then hit a plateau and you're like, man, I'm exercising 7 days a week, I'm eating nothing but bloody veggies and, you know, steamed fish. Where do I go from here? And I haven't lost any weight this week. You get so in your head about this that you're totally off the diet. You're like, what's the point? I'm trying so hard, I can't give anything more, I'm off the diet. So that's why as dietitians, we always recommend like slow and steady wins the race. So sustainable changes long term, not going 1,000 miles an hour from the very beginning. So once you hit that wall, then you've got nowhere to go. And then all of the, you know, the good work that you've done becomes undone when you fall off the diet. So 100% slow and steady. But I think we can both agree, Susie, nutrition is absolutely key from a fat loss perspective.
Ultimately, it always comes back to calorie control and not going from 1,400 calories to 2,500 and back again. It's about keeping it as tight as you can most of the time, and then you'll keep in control of your weight.
Absolutely.
All right. So we'll have some feedback on that, I'm sure, but that's where we're sitting on, is diet or exercise more important at different stages? But a topic that we were going to talk about today that came from some of our work with clients, and specifically I've been seeing this a huge amount in the media over the past few months, and I think it's because some of the key journalists are in their late 40s and 50s, and so they're going through what we're going to talk about, which of course is menopause, right? And their bodies are getting ready for that. Now, the thing about perimenopause, which is the period sort of up to 10 years before actual menopause, when you stop ovulating completely, and the huge number of symptoms you can present with, whether it's hot flushes or weight gain or fatigue or irritability or depression, is that it really links in very powerfully to our nutrition. And I actually haven't seen a huge amount discussed about the role of nutrition and diets in terms of perimenopause and menopause. But when we take a really close look at what's happening physiologically, they're very closely linked. And there's actually some good science as well around managing some of these premenopausal and menopausal symptoms. And also, perhaps from our perspective, Leanne, the weight gain, which is so incredibly common. So I thought today, rather than target an individual client, which is what we normally do, we're going to talk about it as a general theme of perimenopause and menopause and the role of our diets, because I think a lot of people in their sort of mid to late 40s and 50s will really, this will resonate with them. So a few of the key physiological variables that we're dealing with that profoundly impact our nutrition. It's basically a drop in estrogen over time. And our hormones, I often talk about hormones are everything, and absolutely in this stage, a very profound effect on specifically the way we metabolize a number of things, and a very close link to weight gain, because basically estrogen, which reduces as we age, is very protective against weight gain, and specifically weight gain around that abdominal area. So basically, as our estrogen levels reduce, which is linked to a number of other issues like the hot flushes, we are just much more likely to gain weight centrally. And that's where we hear about women who never had issues with a waist before. All of a sudden, they're coming in with waist measurements at 80, 90 centimeters. And this is weight that they've never carried around in their tummy. And sometimes I'll anecdotally hear my female clients talk about it being related to their wine intake. But probably more important, it's that it's likely linked to a reduction in estrogen over time. Now, estrogen is such a powerful hormone. It has such a profound effect over our mood. Also, calcium metabolism, And so we're at much higher risk of developing bone issues, osteopenia, osteoporosis, because we're not as good as metabolizing calcium, which of course is crucial for healthy bones. The other issue is if you're going through perimenopause or menopause and bleeding sporadically, or perhaps bleeding much more often than every 4 weeks, of course you're losing a lot more blood, which means that you're at risk of low iron levels, which again can make you incredibly tired. It can, and if your sleep is already disrupted because of these hormonal changes. So in summary, I would say that preventing any weight gain that is coming as a result of perimenopause and menopause is one of the most powerful things women in their 40s and 50s can do to ensure that they do not have long-term weight issues. Because if you start to gain weight centrally in your 40s and 50s, and instead of being 5 kilos overweight, then suddenly you're 10 or even 20 kilos overweight, it is so profoundly difficult to get weight off centrally once it's been there for a while. If you've noticed that your waist is starting to creep up, taking active steps to prevent that weight gain, and we'll talk about some strategies in a minute, is incredibly, incredibly important. Now, when we take a look at what the science says, it's quite interesting because there has been quite a few studies done, and you're going to talk about one in a minute, specifically about hot flushes, but I'll talk about the main data that's coming out around weight gain and preventing weight gain. And that actually, interestingly enough, comes from a Mediterranean style of eating. So if we take a look at what's happening with a Mediterranean style of eating, it's not an overly technical diet, it's not overly special, but what it does do, it slightly reduces carbohydrate intake because there's a much greater focus on fruit and vegetable intake as opposed to grains and cereals. And it's also very, very rich in omega-3 fats. So they, as we know, are very strongly associated with a reduction in inflammation in the body. And what we also know is that when we're gaining weight centrally, it's probably linked to insulin levels over time. So insulin is one of the main hormones that regulates glucose and fat metabolism in the body, and it actively blocks fat loss when insulin levels are high. So if I take the standard female that I'm seeing of these ages in their 40s and 50s, inevitably they sit down quite a lot because they're working long hours. And they're perhaps not sleeping overly well, particularly if they're going through some of these hormonal shifts. They don't have a lot of time to exercise, so they're probably not doing a lot of weight-bearing activity, so their bones aren't looking overly healthy. They may even have swapped to plant-based eating where they're having almond milk that's not fortified with calcium, so their calcium intake tends to be low. That's a really important factor. And then inevitably, Leanne, a lot of clients we see eat a lot of carbohydrate, way too much for their what's happening in their body in the case of perimenopause and menopause. And they're sitting down and not burning it off. So they're having cereal or toast for breakfast. They're grabbing sandwich or sushi for lunch. They're snacking on rice cakes and fruit because they think it's healthy, or healthy baked goods. And then at night they might have some wine, but also some rice, some pasta. Now that is a high carbohydrate diet. That is not a Mediterranean diet. That is 50 to 60% carbohydrate. And I guarantee if you have got reducing estrogen over time and abdominal weight gain, that will be riding your insulin levels up, and you are in a cycle towards pre-diabetes and type 2 diabetes, which can easily be reversed early if you keep on top of that menopausal weight gain and reduce your carbohydrate slightly and focus your diet around more of a Mediterranean eating. So it's not an overly sexy or flash diet, but the research is strong in terms of reducing inflammation, reducing some of these symptoms, which we'll talk about in a second, and basically preventing this terrible weight gain that happens to a significant number of menopausal women. And not only does it make you feel terrible, it's really, really hard to get off. So the take-home message is that if you know that you've got some perimenopausal, menopausal symptoms, you're not feeling great, probably your estrogen's shifting around, the doctor said you're in perimenopause or even menopause, getting your macronutrient intake and your carbohydrate and preventing and getting that weight off will be one of the most powerful things you can do to preserve your health as you move into your 60s, 70s if you get it off now. That was a big 100%. Spiel.
Love it, love it. And I'm going to summarize that in four key points. So firstly, Mediterranean diet. If you have no idea what that is, book in one-on-one with a dietitian. It will be very beneficial. Weight training. Weight training is so incredibly important for peri and menopause. I cannot stress that enough. It's the time in our life when, you know, we come out of, you know, I think strength training and resistance training is becoming a lot more popular within the 20s and 30s and 40s age group. But then I think life just gets busy, things get in the way, you know, we swap that for longer walks and that sort of thing. So I just think that it's something that drops off. So weight training is so incredibly important, not only for bone health, but for your metabolism as well. After 40, every year, I think the research is something like you lose 2% of your bone mass, or you lose 2% of your muscle mass every year. So your body's working against you. You really need to focus on that resistance training 2 to 3 times a week. If you have no idea what you're doing, hire a trainer, hire a professional. So weight training for bone health and metabolism, calcium, so incredibly important for menopause, particularly if you don't eat dairy. You need 1300 milligrams of dietary calcium a day for menopause. This is for, you know, healthy adults. And that's how many serves, Susie?
Oh, a lot, at least 3 to 4. And that's where some of those super foods like the tuna we've mentioned before, which is very high in calcium. But check your plant-based milks. If you're a plant-based milk person, you have to make sure one's fortified, because often the ones that the baristas are using at the cafes are not. So you think you're having milk and you are not getting any of the protein or the calcium that you think you are.
100%. Skim milk is probably one of our top recommendations for menopause. So if you don't, or you choose not to drink dairy products or eat dairy products, that's absolutely okay. You may or may not need a supplement, or you're going to need to, you know, eat a lot of other bony fish and that sort of thing, dark green leafy vegetables. And also consider an iron supplement if you are bleeding heavily, or if your bleeds have become a lot more irregular. I've talked to clients who, you know, have been bleeding for 6 to 8 weeks. So not only have I sent them to their GP, I've just started them straight on an iron tablet, because if you're going to bleed for 6 to 8 weeks straight, you can rest assured that you're going to feel pretty crappy after a couple of weeks. So really monitor your iron levels if that bleeding is, you know, anything more than sort of that 4 or 5 quote unquote normal period. And then finally, Mediterranean diet has been shown in the research to really help with hot flushes. So there was a big study in, I think it was Australia, Susie, where researchers actually found that menopausal women who ate diets high in fruits, certain veggies, pasta, and even a little bit of red wine, aka a Mediterranean-style eating pattern, were up to 20% less likely to have hot flushes and night sweats. And on the flip side of that, you might think, oh, 20% doesn't sound like a lot, but, you know, if you're someone who's going through hot flushes, it's absolutely worth a trial. But on the flip side of that, menopausal women who ate high-sugar, high-fat diets were 23% more likely to experience hot flushes and night sweats. So I think that that's a great study. And researchers also noted that women who adhered to the low-fat, high-fiber diet trend had lower and more stable estrogen levels overall as well. So there's absolutely things that we can do from a nutrition perspective, but there's a lot of things that you need to think about. So if this is confusing to you, if you're not sure how to focus on your calcium and your iron and implement an intermittent Mediterranean-style diet and stabilize out your hormones, this is a perfect time to book in with a dietitian one-on-one to really optimize your health during a really important time of your life.
It is, and I think some simple tips that they can take away: you've got to get the oily fish 3 times a week, and if you're not a fish eater, look at potential supplementation to get that omega-3 fat up there. And of course, what we would also say, Leanne, is a Mediterranean diet doesn't include processed snack food. There's no biscuits, there's no cakes, there's no rice crackers. You know, it really is more about well-balanced meals through the day and not this frequency of eating that's packed full of sugars and vegetable oils and processing. Mm-hmm. So keeping that as minimal as possible in the diet is a really important part of achieving the balance that the Mediterranean diet supports.
Absolutely. Whole foods first. And don't forget the wine recommendations that come with the Mediterranean diet. a standard glass of wine, I think, as per the Mediterranean diet, is probably about 100 mils. Most people would pour about 300 mils as one glass. And most people struggle to stick to one glass, don't they, Susie?
Probably, they make bigger glasses all of a sudden. It's not our fault. Those glasses are like goblets, and they pour the 100 mil and charge you $17. It's devastating, but that's the standard serve.
So that red wine is not a daily thing. It perhaps doesn't even need to be a weekly thing, just very much mind your intake, because you will find that you get that additional abdominal fat if your intake, particularly of alcohol, is getting up there.
Well, the food that you eat when you're drinking stores, and that's why we get that very pronounced abdominal weight. So people think it's not the wine necessarily, it's the mix of what we're having
cheese
with
it. And the potato chips and the 2 a.m. kebabs.
And the fried food at the pub when we're allowed to go there. So 100% it's the overall pattern of eating. But, you know, it's a very positive diet and an easily sustainable one too. But it will really make a big difference. So if you have any of those symptoms and know that your body is not feeling as good as it once did, definitely invest some time in getting your diet sorted by the right professional, someone who has a dietetics degree, who is qualified in the science of nutrition. It will go a long way in paving the way to a much more positive health position as you get older.
And absolutely, we're going to plug personal trainers here as well and invest in a good trainer now. If you haven't before, is the time to start or really get into your weight training. And I mean, it's not enough to just do sort of simple exercises. We really want to be actually lifting some load and lifting some weight, whether that's dumbbells or kettlebells, or, you know, you're getting into a squat rack, or if you're at home in lockdown, you know, order some weights online, get them delivered. Now is the time to start doing some sort of resistance training. Your bone health is absolutely going to thank you, as will your metabolism long term. So now, Susie, our most popular segment. We know our listeners love this one, and we thought this week we would chat about cakes. So I'm not actually even sure how to pronounce this. Is it Noshu?
I like that. We're going to talk about cakes. Noshu?
After telling you not to eat cakes because it's terrible for menopause, Noshu. Now we're going to talk about cakes.
Well, a lot of us are at home cooking, I think. We're cooking, so it's relevant.
So this is the 99% sugar-free range. We're getting a lot of questions, a lot of DMs and messages through our Instagram account, which is the Nutrition Couch Podcast. They also have a range of the sugar-free chocolate chips as well, but we chose the rich chocolate cake to chat about today. Just on the front of pack labeling, which we always tell you guys just to ignore because it's fancy marketing, it's got 4 stars, it says 50% lower carb, there's a non-dairy option, and it uses natural sweeteners. But Susie, let's flick over to the back of the packet, and do you want to chat our listeners through the nutrition of this 99% sugar-free cake mix and let us know your thoughts?
They've got a really great website. I will, it's a disclaimer here, I haven't tried these products, but I'm like you, I have been asked a lot about them. I guess because I like to bake and I like to bake fairly traditionally, occasionally to get blends. I haven't had a go of this product, but the serving size is 86 grams per slice. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but that is a pretty small piece of cake, because my understanding would be that a cake that you would see if you were buying a piece from a cafe would be close to 200 grams, I'd say. So this is a slither that this is nutritionals have been calculated on.
No, a normal adult human would have an 86 gram slice of cake.
It's very small. So what's 86 grams? It's like, it's like three, you know, if you have a slice of cheese, that's like 20. So it's like a cheese, like it's very little.
Yeah, it's 12 slices. If you were to slice up a normal cake, they're saying you should get 12 slices out of that. And I think most people would get 6 to 8 slices out. I think that's a reasonable assumption. Yeah. I think 12 is very, very slim
pickings. It's pushing it. So the energy is 746 kilojoules, which is just shy of 200 calories. 4.5 grams of protein, which I'd say is coming from the high proportion of wheat flour. 9.9 grams of fat in total and 2.9 saturated. So it's still relatively low saturated fat. 14.6 grams of total carb, 10 grams of fiber because it's got a tapioca fiber bulking it up. The sweetness coming from erythritol, 7.9 grams, so that's not metabolized the way normal sugar is, and hence the overall low sugar content of what they're calculating. And the ingredients, Australian wheat flour, isomaltol oligosaccharides, which is the tapioca flour, erythritol, cocoa powder, polydextrose, corn flour, dextrin fiber, thickener, xylitol, baking powder, stevia, natural flavors. So it does contain gluten. It is not gluten-free. It's also got milk and soy, so it's not appropriate for those who are looking with food allergy or intolerance there. It does say dairy-free on the label, but it says may be present, so it must be made in a factory. And it's got a 4 health star ratings with 50% lower carbs and marketed as using natural sweeteners. Now, people who like sweet food, in my experience, Leanne, love this product. I know a couple of my friends who enjoy cakes and sweet food. They love it. I know it's very popular in the supermarket. I have to be honest with you, it's not something that I recommend. And there's a reason why, probably a few reasons. The first is that I think it's heavily processed. And if I am having someone make a cake, I would much rather it be a natural cake with natural ingredients. And, you know, I often use a wholemeal flour. I tend to use some of the sweeteners like the monk fruit to reduce the overall sugar content of my baking, or olive oil or some plain butter in it. And I can sort of make a pretty good cake with not too much of those ingredients. And also I find they're quite expensive. They're like $7 or $8 a box. So
it's $8, yeah.
I'm not going to usually recommend a client goes and buys that and thinks it's healthier, because for me it's quite processed. Now, I wouldn't stop someone buying it. I would give recommendations on how they can enjoy it if they want to, but it wouldn't be top of my list of recommendations, because as a dietitian, I think it's using a lot of processed ingredients, and I don't want my clients to think that eating cake is okay just because it appears slightly healthier. I want them to keep cake as a very occasional thing they include in their diet, you know, for a birthday or a special occasion, or if they're really feeling like it. but I wouldn't be encouraging them to make cake as part of their normal weekly meal plan, because if you make a cake, you're probably going to eat it. And that's a problem, because it still is calories, and most of us can't deal with eating 3 or 4 pieces of that kind of cake in our meal plan on a daily basis. So, you know, I think it can have a role if people like it, but it definitely isn't top of my list when I'm recommending products, because I like to keep the diet as sort of unprocessed and natural as possible. I don't know. What do you think?
I agree. I wouldn't recommend this to my clients. I mean, if they came to me and they said, I love it, it's one of my soul foods, can we include it? I'd say, yeah, absolutely. But this isn't something that I'd recommend, particularly because, I mean, if we're being honest, like an average serving size, no one's going to cut that cake into 12 slices, let's be real. An average serving size is at least 300 calories. So from a calorie perspective, it's probably very similar or maybe slightly less than just a normal piece of cake. I agree it's overly processed. The fiber content's pretty good, but at the same time, maybe too much for some people who don't tolerate fiber that well. You may get a few excessive bits of gas or wind after a product like this. And I mean, the ratios of, you know, it's high fat, low carb, or low sugar, should I say. So for some people that might fit their macros a little bit better. But overall, I really don't think, I think for $8 a pop, you'd be much better making it yourself. And I agree with you. I personally don't bake, A, because I don't have kids. So if I bake, David and I have an entire cake. Well, like, what the hell are we going to do with a whole cake? And, you know, I don't work at the hospital anymore. We're not really going out, you know, we're not in here in lockdown in Brisbane, but I'm also not going out and about on purpose either, just because being pregnant, I'm a little bit worried and, you know, I'm not going to too many places. So I'm not going to friends' houses and going to big parties and barbecues, or I'm taking cakes and that sort of thing with me. So I don't really bake. And so I agree. I haven't tried this either. I'm not sure of the texture or the mouthfeel, or there's a hell of a lot of artificial sweeteners in there. And at fiber as well, I don't really know what the texture of that would feel like if you were
natural,
to consume it.
The natural sweeteners. But you're right, there's still sweeteners in there.
Oh, yeah.
Xylitol, so this is sweeteners. Yeah. But yeah, no, I agree with you. And there is a difference between artificial and natural sweeteners. But I agree with you that when you're having product with sweetener and specific ingredients like the tapioca, it changes the mouthfeel. So if you think about a high-fat product, whether it's even avocado or cake or baking, you know, rich brownie or rich cake, it's got a real texture to it, and that gives a lot of satisfaction, a lot of pleasure. The issue I have with some of these heavily processed products is that they don't give that same mouthfeel, and it's almost too sweet. It's not a natural sweetness. So it sort of changes the way we process and enjoy that product. And I think that sometimes if you don't get that same satisfaction load that you would normally get with cake, you actually eat more of it. And I was thinking, because you said that there's 12 serves, that means that in the half of a cake, I'm trying to visualize it, that's 6 pieces in half a cake. Now, most of us wouldn't cut that. We'd cut it into 4, I think. So yeah, you're right. You're probably getting more like 250, even up to 300 calories in the serve that should be described. And that doesn't make it that much lower than regular cake. So to put it in perspective, if you cut your cake, probably 8 pieces is how we normally cut it, not 12.
Absolutely. And I mean, the boxes, it's $8 a pop. You still need to add milk, 3 eggs, some sort of non-dairy spread or butter into it, and then you've got to add frosting to that as well.
Haven't calculated that either.
No, that's preparing the cake like normal, but using a light non-dairy spread. So again, if you were to sub for butter, the calorie content would go over or increase, and that's also using water. So again, if you were to use a milk, which they could actually recommend, they say a cup of milk, slush nut milk or water. Mm. So they've calculated that a nutritionist using a light non-dairy spread and water. So the overall calories of that, if you were to use a skim milk plus some butter, would probably be over 200 calories a slice. And again, let's be real about the serving size. It's probably going to be 300 calories upwards of that. My view has always been with these types of things, I call soul food, Susie, have what you want and get the maximum benefit out of it and move on. Like if I felt like a piece of cake, I would go to my local cafe, buy a piece, whether I ate a few spoons of it, half of it, shared it with David, whatever it was, and then I'd move on. I wouldn't then have 3/4 of a cake sitting in my fridge begging me to eat it for the next couple of days. So I really do think, particularly if your goal is around fat loss, it's just that temptation. You can't bake a whole cake and not expect to eat the whole cake within a couple of days. So yeah. I think reducing that temptation, particularly if you're at home in lockdown, is probably a good idea. And I definitely think you can do a much better version yourself at home. As you mentioned, some of my favorite natural type of sweeteners are monk fruit to bake with as well.
And I think it's really bad form to suggest people use those spreads to mix a cake. Like, not only nutritionally is that introducing really processed fat, it won't mix well in a cake. nor will unsweetened almond milk. So you're going to end up with an interesting product, and definitely not be my recommendation ever to use a processed plant spread.
That's to keep it vegan, I think, because there's a non-vegan option on the label. So they're suggesting a non-dairy plant spread, which is highly processed,
and that plus
some sort
well.
Of plant-based milk as well. Yeah, so who knows what the final product is going to come out
with. I can't imagine what it's like. So, yeah, that we don't want to be too negative. But if we're being honest, yeah, I would definitely not be making it using the recommended. If I did make it, I would absolutely use butter. I think olive oil would taint it too much flavor-wise. Perhaps a light olive oil you could try, but I definitely would not be doing it on an unsweetened milk. I would absolutely use a dairy to at least get some thickness to it. So, yeah, interesting product, but very popular. People seem to like them, but it's definitely not on my prescribed list for my clients.
I think people like them because, like we talked about, correct me if I'm wrong, last week's episode was on health halos. This is 100% a health halo. But then that the perception is you're making a healthier sugar-free cake. So what do? You go and you eat two or three slices of it instead of just one, because there's that perceived benefit that this is healthier. And this is my whole gripe with the whole marketing industry, Susie, and what people forget is because they think it's healthier, then they go and eat a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more. And before you know it, you've had 500 calories of your sugar-free cake, which who cares if there's no sugar in it? It's still 500 calories, which contributes to your calorie load overall. So my view has always been, if you're going to have some sort of treat, have the treat that you want the most, enjoy the heck out of it, eat it mindfully, and just move on after that. And I think for a lot of people, we're best not to bake an entire cake unless we've got 12 kids at home who may be able to help us out and eat it. If not, if it's just you at home or it's you and a partner or something, you're better off probably just going to buy a small piece from a local cafe and supporting them, or, you know, maybe even just a quartering the recipe and making it in a little tin instead of using the entire box, perhaps is a better idea as well. We don't have to bake the entire cake. We can make those little, you know, tiny ramekin sort of 1-2 serve cakes. Could be a better option.
But if it looks like cake, it's probably cake.
We always say, yep, health halos.
All right. Well, that is leading us to our final segment. And we had a listener question come up, and we do go through all of your questions that come through on Instagram at the Nutrition Couch podcast. So feel free to send them through. And this one was about how do we approach nutrition for young girls, so adolescent girls, as they are starting to go through puberty, because of course their bodies are going through some changes. Sometimes they stop doing their regular exercise. They're not doing as much sport. They might gain some weight, or they might be coming quite obsessed or focused on food. So someone asked, you know, how do we broach that with teenage girls? And I'll kick us off, because I have worked with adolescents for my entire career, and it can be a really challenging time given that there's a lot of social media modeling around diets and food, and it can become quite a focal point. I think the thing that I really try and focus on as a starting point is maintaining some sort of physical activity. I think one of the most profound thing that changes with teenage girls, particularly as they move through their senior years of high school, is they often become really sedentary. So if they're not naturally into a big sport, they'll suddenly give up any other weekend sport, and all of a sudden they're online all the time, which inevitably means they're sitting. And so if they're prone to weight gain because of their changes of going through puberty, and then also having a lot of teenage snack food or eating out with their friends at shopping centres and starting to order Uber Eats and all the things that teenagers do. For example, we know that teenagers are one of the greatest consumers of soft drink. Inevitably, that's a recipe for disaster for a lot of teenagers, because they gain weight, they're sitting around a lot more, they're not doing any exercise. So factoring in regular movement and activity, even if it's walking with friends or a gym membership, a number of the gyms, including Fitness First, when things open up again, have a special teenage membership that they can utilize in holidays, and just making sure that physical activity becomes a regular part of the family environment. And that's really important for parents who work full time and don't get home till after the kids are home from school. You can then safely assume they've been sitting down on their device or computer or doing homework for 3 to 4 hours a day. So just making sure that movement becomes a regular part of family life is really important. I think be really focused on what foods you stock at home. So it never ceases to amaze me that parents will bring kids in, and young kids as well, and they'll be whinging about their food habits and their snack food behavior. But at the end of the day, someone is keeping that processed snack food or white bread in the house. So if you want your kids to be healthy, making sure that the bulk of the food in the house is healthy and they don't have access to as much of that packaged processed food goes a huge way in cementing these really positive behaviors. And the other thing, I guess it's becoming a family project where everyone's eating pretty well. Like, it's really difficult to ignite change if you've got a dad who is eating really poorly and not exercising, or a mum who gets home late and perhaps isn't having proper meals. So the more that the family can demonstrate and give good health examples as part of their day-to-day, the better that's going to be for especially younger teenagers, say aged between 10 and 14. Of course, once girls get a little bit older, they're a lot more self-sufficient. But in those really dominant years, say 10 to 14, maintaining really healthy habits within the household, stocking the foods that you want them to eat, not having soft drink and juice around and keeping a certain level of physical activity all goes a really long way in cementing some of these positive health habits.
And I think you mentioned a good point, like you have to be the role model. And that's the thing, like clients used to come into the hospital and say, you know, talk about their own, you know, their own nutrition concerns, but then bring their teenage kids into it as well. And it's like somebody is either buying that food. And I mean, once they're, you know, 16, 17, they're earning their own income, that's a different story. But in their younger teens, if you're going to supply that food, chances are those kids are going to eat it. So it's really around what you're buying and supplying and how you're being a role model. If kids are like sponges, if they're going to grow up and see mum start a new diet every 4 weeks or mum never eats carbs at dinner, those things are going to rub off on teenagers. And teenagers, there's so much fear around carbohydrates and fear around sugar. And they just... we want to focus on nutrition positively. So seeing nutrition as fuel for our body, focus on exercise and movement that they enjoy. Talk about fueling their bodies for energy, eating for health, eating for energy, eating and listening to their bodies, learning those skills of mindful and intuitive eating. Regular meal patterns as well is a really important thing, especially for teenagers. They're going through some of them really, really large growth spurts. I know that when I was I think I've been about 6 foot tall since about 14 years old, Susie. Like I was a big kid, like height-wise. And I used to eat, you know, sometimes more than my dad. And my mum never said anything. She was like, as long as you're hungry, you can have more. And it was always within my control to learn to regulate that. And kids are really great regulators of their own appetite and fullness levels. We want to continue to carry that into, you know, our teenage years as well. So be that really good role model for your child. Allow them to build their own plate. Don't always serve them what you think is an appropriate portion, because teenagers are hungrier some days and they're not as hungry other days. But I really do think that young girls in particular go through so many changes in puberty. We get stretch marks, we, you know, have bloody periods and we have acne, and it's a really tough time. But the more you talk about that and are open with your kids, I think the easier that becomes for them. And just monitor their movements online. Be really, really wary about who they're following on social media. A lot of these celebrities are airbrushing their photos and they're just doing ridiculous things for their photos and distorting their bodies through Photoshop in a way that's not even real. And if teenage girls are growing up thinking that cellulite isn't normal or acne isn't normal or bloating isn't normal, then that's not a good thing. So really be wary that they're following some good positive role models online. And honestly, there are so many these days on social media, good positive role models. Just go through their feed and talk to them about, you know, who they should be following, because this is real life. And this is the Instagram glamorized, I look perfect in every photo, which just isn't the real deal. So when teenage girls start to get some stretch marks, and I had quite a few stretch marks because I had huge growth spurts during puberty, you know, and they start to see a little bit of cellulite on the back of their legs and they freak out and they think, oh my goodness, I'm the only one who has this, and they try to cover it up. It's really nice to be following people on social media who normalize that and say, you know, the majority of people have stretch marks and cellulite and that sort of thing, not the minority, which is what we think because of social media. So I really do think monitor their social media accounts and put them in touch with really positive role models on social media as well. And focus on change as a normal part of growing up. Like try to normalize it as best as you can. And in terms of nutrition, get them into the kitchen, get them cooking, teaching them to eat as much color and as much diversity as possible. Take them into the shops and let them choose different types of fruits and veggies and get them involved in the meal planning. And once or twice a week, get them into the kitchen cooking with you, because young girls, most of them love cooking. They love being creative. Allow that to happen, and you'll find that nutrition is a lot easier for them as they grow up, if they're learning about foods and learning how to nourish and fuel their body versus seeing mum do every single diet and never eat carbs at dinner time. There's a lot we can do in terms of supporting young girls from a nutrition perspective.
100%. And a shift away from teaching them to order in as a routine part of the diet, because I find a lot of busy families will be ordering dinners in 3-4 times a week. And that has a really strong follow-on effect to kids thinking it's normal to be eating takeaway and fried home-delivered meals regularly when you're busy. So definitely use their skills, getting them in the kitchen. They're very capable, particularly girls as they get, you know, a little bit older. And probably the last take-home message is also, if you have a teenage girl who decides to become vegetarian or even vegan, get them to a dietitian, an accrediting practicing dietitian, to balance their diet out early and make sure they don't become risk of disordered eating and restrictive eating patterns and ticking the box on their essential nutrients like their protein, calcium, iron. Incredibly important for that target group.
Absolutely. I mean, I used to work with a lot of, we'd had a lot of eating disorder clients at the hospital, and it broke my heart to see 20-year-olds with backgrounds in disordered eating since they were teens have problems with their bones at 20 years old, like multiple fractures, and being told that you will probably always be osteoporotic and you're 20 years old. So we don't want that to happen. So absolutely, if your teenagers are coming to you saying, I'm vegetarian, I only drink almond milk, I won't touch sugar, there are some red flags in terms of disordered eating. Not saying that your teenager might have an eating disorder, but it can very quickly go from a disordered eating pattern and wanting to be quote unquote healthy. And that healthy takes a couple of steps too far. And that goes down the path of disordered eating, which goes down the path of an eating disorder. So absolutely get a professional such as a dietitian involved early to teach your children how to nourish and fuel their bodies and not restrict them or diet them or follow other online social media influencers. And there is a very big vegan and plant-based push online at the moment. I'm not saying that it's a bad thing to be plant-based, but you can absolutely do it wrong and cause more harm than good. So do not let your teenage girls in particular cut out a lot of nutrients without the support of a professional. So incredibly important.
100%.
Wonderful. All right. Well, Susie, that brings us to the end of the Nutrition Couch for another week. It's sad, but we'll be in your inbox next week, guys. So if you haven't done so already, please don't forget to subscribe. So a lot of the rankings in the charts are actually based on subscription. So if you love us and you listen to us every week, please make sure you subscribe to the podcast, because that actually helps boost us in the charts. And the higher we are in the charts, the more people that we can reach and the more we can continue on with this podcast. So make sure you give us a follow at the Nutrition Cap Podcast on Facebook and Instagram. Shoot us through any questions. Make sure you comment on our posts and let us know if you're enjoying the episodes, what your favorite part is. And if you've got any suggestions for future episodes, please let us know. And we will be in your inbox Sunday morning next week. And thank you for listening.
Have a great week.